This is Build and Analyze, a weekly news and discussion show about the world of iPhone, iPad, iOS, and mobile web development. Show is hosted by Marco Arment. He's the creator, founder of Instapaper, now the magazine. By me, I'm Dan Benjamin. Today is Monday, November 5th, 2012. This is our 102nd episode. We would like to make sure that we thank our lovely sponsors. We've got four of them, so we'll make it straightforward for you. MailChimp.com, Squarespace.com, Hover.com, and SensibleWorld.com. These are the guys who make Symbolicons. I'll tell you all about those as the show continues. And, of course, we have a bandwidth sponsor for the month of November. It's MindNode, an intuitive mind mapping app for Mac and iOS. Whether you're brainstorming for your next project, organizing your life, planning your vacation, it don't matter. That's their slogan. They're going to run with that. It don't matter. It's integrated iCloud sharing. It lets you collect, structure, and expand your ideas in a very, very cool way. Check these guys out at mindnode.com.
A lot of people asking me about putting settings in the settings app.
Right.
This was a debate back in the very beginning of the App Store. Back when apps first started being able to be made, because all the way back then in iOS 2.0, you had the ability with an app to create a special plist file or files in your app and be able to put the settings for your app in the system settings app. And if you go to your system settings app now, there's probably a handful of apps that have their settings there now, and you can go look, certain thing, you can put stuff there. And
now, I have a really quick question for you, something I've always wondered. Yeah. Do you need to launch an app before it creates that little settings block for you, or is it there just after installation?
I don't know the answer to that. However, there is no code reason why you need to launch the app first, because it's literally just a plist file in the app. So I imagine it's just upon installation and updates to the app that thing is updated.
Okay.
If you remember back then in like 2008 when the App Store launched, from the very beginning, there was a debate about where apps should put their settings, whether they should put it there or in the app itself and have some kind of button or menu or icon that launches the settings screen. When we spent so much of last episode talking about the magazine and my dilemma of trying to avoid having a settings screen, and then the conclusion that I came to was that the initial design goal of not having a settings screen actually made us make a couple of bad design decisions to achieve that, and therefore it wasn't a good design goal. And so in 1.1, which I've since submitted to Apple, although it hasn't been approved yet, but it's only been a couple of days, in 1.1, I added a settings screen in the app. And a lot of people ask me, why didn't I do the settings in the settings app? I believe we actually visited this topic like almost 2 years ago, like in one of the very first episodes of the show. But it's worth revisiting now because so many people asked me about it last week.
And you had only one app out back then. Now you've got two.
Right, exactly. And Instapaper does not use the settings app. It uses its own built-in settings. There's even, I should mention, because everyone will tell me if I don't, there's even an open source code thing, I forget what it's called, that allows you to have the settings in the settings app, and then this library that you put into the app lets you also bring up those settings in the app. It just reads the same plist file and interprets it and makes a settings screen. So you can kind of do both. But one common rule that people would use would be, if you should put settings in the settings app that are very rarely used. For instance, if you have an app like Instapaper and you manually switch dark mode on and off depending on the room you're in, that's a frequently used option. So you don't want to put that somewhere outside of the app. That needs to be accessible and convenient. So people say, okay, we'll put put frequently used things in the app and put infrequently used things outside of the app. That might be a good rule. However, I don't like that. For the same reason why I don't like using the settings app at all, there are two major problems with it. Number one, does not get solved by that. Problem number one is that people just don't look there. Most users don't think to look in the system settings app for the settings for your app. it just doesn't happen. I've heard from a few, I heard back a long time ago when this whole argument started, I heard from a number of developers who said they got tons of support emails and tons of like one-star reviews from people complaining about the lack of a feature that actually was supported, just you had to go into the system settings screen to find it. And so, you know, you can, it's like, you know, tree falling in the woods. If you have a setting but nobody can find it, you know, what's the point of having it? You're still going to have all of the problems of not having that setting from people who don't find it. So that doesn't really solve, like putting infrequent use settings there, you might as well just not put anything there. The other thing is the settings bundles, because there's no code involved, it's literally just a P list that you configure and say, okay, put, you know, make a button or make an item here that's a switch on or off, make a picker here that's these few items, you can make a slider here. But it's very limited in what you can do. You can't run any code. And critically, the app might not even be running when you're adjusting these settings. So for instance, you know, what do I need settings for in the magazine? One of them I talked about last time is a log out of Instapaper button. Well, the settings bundles can't contain buttons that do things. It's literally just like switches and pickers and stuff. And there's no reaction that you can generate. So log out of Instapaper, there's no way to do that there. That has to execute code. It has to be a button that executes code. Some apps have used the settings bundles as kind of like a master override, like a main reset switch. And what they will do is a stupid hack where they will actually they'll use a UI switch control, and they'll say like reset all settings next time you launch on, you know. And if you flip that to on, then next time the app launches, it nukes all of its data and kind of resets itself, and then it switches that in code to off. So you can go back again sometime and flip it back on again. That's really a pretty clunky workaround. But for the most part, you know, you can't have buttons. So if I did want to have a logout of Instapaper thing there, I would have to make it a switch that just was always off, unless you flipped it to on, and the next time you launched the app, I would log out of Instapaper for you and then flip that switch back to off in code. It's just a hack, and it doesn't work. And the other thing is, you know, there's a lot of settings, like most of Instapaper settings have some kind of dynamic behavior to them. You know, the whole, like if you go through the Instapaper settings screen, like basically the top half of it, almost all of those have to do something in response. It isn't just like a preference that you just pick. You know, the bottom half has a whole bunch of like little nitpicky preferences, and most of those could be done in the settings app, but anything dynamic you can't do. Like changing the color, I want to change the color of the app in response. Like some of those things launch web pages or launch other actions. So in the magazine, you know, there's logout of Instapaper. There's also the manage subscription button, which is just a link to the section in the app store that manages auto-renewing subscriptions. You can't have a link be one of the things in your settings screen. It just doesn't work that way. So if you do the system settings thing. And then the other thing is, with the magazine settings pane, I actually dynamically hide options that aren't needed or that don't make sense in the current setup. So, for instance, if you are not logged into Instapaper, I don't show the logout button because that doesn't make sense.
That would be confusing.
Right. If you are already subscribed, I don't show the subscribe button. Again, doesn't make sense. For the browser choice, I will give you a choice of which installed browser to use if you have any of the supported third-party browsers installed. So, one, you know, Chrome or like Opera Mini or iCab. It supports like 9 different browsers, but it will only show the ones that you actually have installed. Obviously, I'm not going to offer to open links in iCab if you don't have iCab installed, because then if you try to open a link, just nothing would happen. So that's no good. So this is a long way of saying the reason why I don't do settings in the settings app is both because it's very limited in what you can do, and what I want to do couldn't really be done very well there, and also because nobody finds it there, and so that kind of ruins the point of having them. Oh, and people in the chat have given me the link. The open source code thing that I referenced earlier is called In-App Settings Kit. And I will add it to the show notes. That's that. Although the screenshot still has the iOS 4 style UI switches So I wonder if this might be a little bit abandoned. We'll see. All right. So with that out of the way, I did want to spend most of this episode discussing basically finishing the magazine design decisions topic that we started. Yes. Last week was an anomaly because we had to out Syracuse, and that was a weird scheduling
that
day.
That was a good thing. That was great, though.
It worked really well. I'm very happy with that.
I'm very pleased with that. And if you'd ever like to do that again, just as a surprise, like spontaneous thing, I'm totally up for that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you don't get that opportunity very often. So, you know, we had to take advantage of it.
Totally. So let's do a quick sponsor then before we dive in. Diving into your new topic, our first sponsor this week is Squarespace.com. Everything you need to make an amazing website. Now, let me tell you what these guys are, and then we go into what they've been doing. They're a fully hosted, completely managed environment for creating and maintaining a beautiful website or blog or portfolio. So no matter how experienced you are with building sites, you can build something pretty amazing in just a few minutes. You don't have to worry about hosting it or scaling it. And, you know, these guys, they really take this stuff seriously. If you saw, they absolutely were affected by Hurricane Sandy up there in New York. And these guys were carrying like their diesel fuel up 17 flights of stairs to keep this stuff running, and they did it. And it's a pretty amazing story. They've got amazing, beautiful templates that you can use. They've got everything you want to do is done with this drag and drop editor. Now, if you happen to be the type that wants full control over HTML and CSS and JavaScript, well, you can switch to developer mode and you can check this stuff out in your own Git repository and push your updates that way or using SFTP. I mean, it's amazing. And of course, everything's responsive. It restructures automatically as you look at this stuff on your favorite browser, whether it's iOS, Mac, who cares? Go to the special URL squarespace.com/5x5. When you sign up for a year, you get a free custom domain name. You spend $10 a month for the standard plan, $20 for the unlimited plan. Automatically get these discounts. But if you want an additional 10% off, no matter what you sign up for, code is DanSentMe11, because this is the month of 11. Squarespace.com/5x5. Go check them out. Topic. Big topic.
Big topic.
Huge.
We're going to talk more about the Microsoft Surface. No. Thank God.
How are you enjoying your Surface, by the way?
Oh, man. No, I didn't buy one. Although, you know what? Honestly, when I went to the Microsoft store and wrote that big blog post about how kind of awkward it was, I hadn't in my mind ruled out the possibility that I would buy one there. I really was going to try it, thinking that it might be really good. And what I found was in general, what I found was that it's decent, but not for me. Like, as I said last episode, it's really great for people who... I assume it's going to be really great for people who are really into the Windows ecosystem, but it really is a Windows PC at the heart of it. And so if that's what you, and that's both a plus and a minus. If that's what you want, then it's going to be a great choice for you. If you don't like Windows PCs, it's probably not going to fit you very well. I've done both. I spent the entirety of my youth and even the beginning of my career on Windows PCs. I used to build Windows PCs. I used to even attempt to overclock my Windows PC, which I never really kept for very long because I was always too scared to melt things. And I know all about heat sinks and big fans and slow fans and the copper inlays in the heat sinks. And even that one heat sink that had the big silver dye at the bottom, it was like made of silver because it was a better heat transfer thing, it cost way too much money. Putting Dynamat in my case. I did that. and all sorts of fun stuff. I spent a lot of time with PCs. I'm very familiar with PCs.
And you have a special place in your heart for PCs.
I did have a special place in my heart for PCs.
That's long gone.
Microsoft took a direction with XP and beyond that I really didn't like. I was a huge fan of Windows 2000. I think Windows 2000 was one of the best operating systems in the last few decades for its time. It was extremely ahead of its time for one, and it was just amazing. But I really just did not. After XP, they started going in a direction where it just clashed with me, and this really is kind of a cultural, not necessarily a cultural battle, but a cultural fit issue. So you know, if you like Windows PCs, you'll probably never be that happy with most Apple products, and vice versa, I think. So anyway, to respond to Nick Hadetti in the chat room, the silver heatsink I was talking about is not Arctic Silver. That's thermal paste. I believe it was called the Silverado, and it might have been by Noise something. There was a heatsink company that specialized in low noise products that began with Noise something, and it was German. I think it was called the Silverado was the product I'm talking about. It basically had a big circular silver die in the bottom of it. Anyway. So Noise Control might have been the company name, now that I think about it. Anyway. that was like a Merlin distraction.
It was. You went down the rabbit hole.
Oh yeah, Nick Hadetti seems to be confirming that I'm correct. It was called Noise Control, and the product was called Silverado. Okay. So back to the magazine design. Full screen mode is a occasional request I get for it now. It does not have a full screen mode. And the intent of the design, in the spirit of not having unnecessary settings and stuff, the intent of the design, I've always hated full screen modes. Instapaper didn't have one until like 6 months ago or something, or fairly recently, maybe earlier this year. Instapaper did not have one for a very long time. I just don't like full screen modes because I always get caught in that loop of, oh, I want it to be full screen. Let me tap the screen right now. And right as I think to tap the screen, it starts fading out automatically after like the two or four second timer. So then I tap the screen and it brings the toolbar back up again. That's happened to me with the built-in iOS Photos viewer, with the video player. It's happened to me with every app that has full screen on iOS. That has happened to me numerous times. And it just drives me crazy. It's just a little annoyance that is frequent enough that it drives me nuts. So when I did develop Instapaper's full screen mode, I tried to work around that annoyance somewhat by setting the timer a little more aggressively and by doing things like when you scroll to the first or last page in an article, it automatically brings the toolbar back up with the assumption that if you are on if you're going through an article, when you get to the last page, you're probably about to do something with the toolbar. You're probably going to either archive it or like it, or somehow you're at least going to go back to the article list. So you need the toolbar when you're at the end. So might as well show it automatically. So I do like little stuff like that with Instapaper to try to make full screen annoy me less. But I've always hated that whole modal transition of, you know, which mode are you in? Are you in full screen mode? And then do you tap? And then, you know, how do you get to things? It has always annoyed me. And I see that as being kind of a hack. So with the magazine's design, my goal was to not even need a full screen mode, to make the regular interface have almost nothing on it when you're reading so that nobody even asks for a full screen mode. And for the most part, it has succeeded. I really have had fairly few requests for it. And I think the requests I have had for it have not necessarily been reasonable. So, you know, like there's always going to be those people who are like, I can't have anything on my desk. I can't have anything on my screen. It's going to distract me from reading. I can't read. Oh my God. There's an extent of that I will cater to. And then it just gets ridiculous. And I think the magazine's current layout does not really demand a full screen mode. The status bar is still shown. I'm a big fan of the status bar. It shows battery information and the time, which for me is very important. Even when I'm reading, I want to see those things. In fact, I'm still, if you guys can all email Lauren Brichter and tell him to make an option to show the status bar during letterpress. I'm trying to convince him to do that. And I think if all of our, like, you know, million listeners email him, that might help convince him. So please email Lauren Brichter. Anyway, so
how many emails do you, or just tweet the guy?
Or yeah, Twitter's probably better because I don't want to. I mean, I'm not going to give you his email address, but even if you can find it, Twitter's probably better. So yeah, it's Lauren B or 8bits.
Yeah.
Anyway, so where was I? Oh yeah, so full screen mode. All right. One of the challenges with doing this is even with my full screen mode, or even with my lack of a need of full screen mode, I have to put the buttons somewhere of basically right now the magazine has two buttons in the reading view. It has one that shows the sidebar, which actually isn't necessary because you just swipe to show the sidebar. But the button is nice for people who either haven't figured that out yet or who have trouble with the swipe, or like in VoiceOver, it's nice to have an actual button there to cause this navigational action to happen so you don't have to like kind of fake the swipe with VoiceOver, which is not easy and a lot of people don't know how to do it. So I need to have that button. Like, it seems redundant, but in practice it should be there. And then the other button is the sharing button. The, you know, the little actions arrow, that's the system standard sharing button. So on iPad, my solution was to basically put each of those in the, there's one each of those buttons in the two top corners. So top left shows the sidebar because the sidebar comes in from the left. Top right is the actions button. And I put them in the margins. And so as you scroll up, those buttons stay fixed. It's like in CSS, it's like if you have position fixed on something. Those buttons stay fixed so that as the text scrolls past them, they just stay in the margins. And I've set the margins such that they're wide enough to accommodate that. On the iPhone, it's a little different because on the iPhone, you can't set the margins that wide. There, it just wouldn't leave any room for text. And I established years ago my favorite iPhone margin size of about, I think it's 10 pixels. I have to double check with Instapaper, but I like that margin size a lot. It's been one of the biggest differentiators between me and my Instapaper competitors, is that they all choose different margin sizes on the iPhone. But it's very important because it's very hard to get a lot of text in one line on the iPhone. Anyway, so on the iPhone, I didn't have enough margin space to have those buttons be fixed there on the sides for all the time. And visually, I didn't like the look of having them like in a bar that stayed on top like a toolbar.
Oh, right, right.
And a toolbar would also look stupid with just two buttons in it. So visually, I didn't care for that. I considered that during one of the early betas, I had actually a third button right in the middle to adjust text size. But that looked stupid too. And it looked even worse on iPad. So now I have them, rather than being like position fixed, they're more like position absolute. They scroll with the content. And this is not that ideal in the sense that if you're in a very long article, you have to scroll all the way back to the top to view the article list again if you don't swipe, or to hit the sharing button. But in practice, so far, nobody has complained about that at all. I thought it might be a problem, but it's not. So far we're doing pretty well on that. And so basically, as you're reading on the iPad, all you see are those two buttons and the status bar. And on the iPhone, all you see is the status bar. So it basically is full screen mode all the time. And that to me, I really don't ever intend to add an option that makes it even more full screeny by like hiding the status bar or something. I just don't see that as necessary. I think when the default interface is this barren, basically, if you're only going to hide like one thing in full screen mode, what's the point? It's adding a lot of annoyance during use, in my opinion, at least. It's adding a lot of annoyance, adding a lot of code complexity. And it's, you know, for benefit of hiding a 20 pixel tall status bar, it's not worth it.
And that's how you make a lot of these decisions. You decide if something is going to be worth the trouble. And this is something that's interesting because you spend I think all iOS developers spend a lot of time thinking about this, but you really sweat this kind of stuff. I mean, this is like,
oh yeah,
this is really up there.
The positioning of those buttons was probably the hardest design decision we had to make, me and Pacific Helm, on this. And it drove me crazy. Like, I iterated so many, I tried having four buttons because originally, in the original design, the toolbar at the bottom of the article list was not there. So all those controls, at first it was just dark mode and text size, had to go on the article. And so we had to figure, where the heck do we put this thing? And so initially, you know, it was four buttons, dark mode and text size on the other side. And again, it looked stupid. Didn't really work. It looked cluttered. Like, if I did that, I would have had to also have a full screen mode. And so this was the alternative of, I put these buttons in the toolbar because they're not really that frequently toggled, the toolbar on the article list. It's not the best design in the world, but I think it's the best solution that we have come up with so far. So anyway, and yeah, I mean, I sweat these details like crazy. I actually kept screenshots of all the different iterations that I did and the Pacific Helm did during the development of this. Sometime I'll publish it somewhere. Just basically the design history of the magazine, like how this came to be.
Would
what
you
we
do
tried
it,
first?
Would you do it as an article in the magazine?
That wouldn't really fit the magazine. That would be a little bit too like meta and technical, and yeah. Honestly, probably boring. That wouldn't really fit, but. I would probably do it as a blog post on my site.
Okay. Marco.org.
That's right, yeah.
I've been there.
Not Marco.com. I believe that's still an auto parts supplier, or maybe it's the ophthalmic company.
Speaking of domains, right? We'll do hover.com, simplified domain management. These guys are great. I register all my domains with them, and I have for a long time, and it's because they make it incredibly simple and easy to register domain, and they don't sell you a whole bunch of garbage that you don't actually want. .com.net, they got that. They also do the .co, the .tv, a whole bunch of them. They have a little search box. You enter the domain name that you want in the search box. If it's available, click the plus, it's yours. That's it. They have a little plus button. If it's not available, they'll show you some alternatives. You can also just enter in keywords, phrases, things that you like, and they'll come up with a whole bunch of alternatives showing you things that are available and things that are not available that you can buy using their services. It's really, really easy. They have it's a really cool domain name valet transfer service where they'll actually handle the whole transfer for you. When you transfer a domain, you get however much time is remaining over your old registrar plus a year from them. It's very cool stuff. Toll-free 800 number. And I'm going to give you 10% off. Go to hover.com/Dan sent me. Now keep in mind, just going there and learning about them using that URL will show that you're listening to the show. It supports the show. But when you go there, use that code Dan sent me, and you get 10% off everything you buy, including your email hosting. So go check them out, hover.com/DanSendMe.
I use that code constantly with them because I buy all my stuff from them now.
I use the heck out of
them. They really are great. So anyway, all right, moving on. Another very common question I've gotten for the magazine's design, which I think is worth talking about, is why are there such limited text options, like, you know, font and metrics options? And so, you know, if you look at Instapaper, I have eight different premium fonts now. And plus, you know, a handful, I think six or seven system fonts. And so there's all these different font options. There's three different color schemes, light, dark, and sepia or sepia. How do you say that?
I never know. I think it's sepia.
I'm not really sure. Anyway,
I like sepia,
light, dark,
but it's
and
sepia.
Beige. And... and then you can also adjust margin width, and you can even adjust line height and text size, of course. And so there's tons of these things in Instapaper. And so people asked me, you know, why didn't you bring all that into the magazine? A lot of people expected they would have all the same controls. And there were basically two reasons for this. One was, again, just complexity, cost. Fonts cost a lot to license. And you know, the complexity takes a lot of development time. Keep in mind that before the magazine launched, when I was writing all this stuff, I had no idea whether it would succeed or not. And so it's usually a better idea with stuff like this to come out earlier with a more basic feature set and then add stuff later if it succeeds, rather than investing even more months and way more money into something only to see that it wasn't a very good idea, or the market's not there for it, and it fails. So I wanted to just save time and save a whole bunch of money on not licensing a ton of different fonts. The other thing is that with Instapaper, I kind of regret having so many options because people are too easily able to shoot themselves in the foot and make bad settings for themselves. For instance, I don't think the line height button is a good idea at all anymore. I added that years ago. I now no longer want that to be there. Margins I can understand a little bit. Font, I have tons of fonts to choose from now. It's actually a pretty nice competitive advantage, but I don't really need all of those. In fact, I think I've been thinking for a while of just not making the system fonts available options anymore.
Oh, really?
Or at least like, you know, having a preference somewhere, which I hate.
To force people to observe your preferences, your personal font preferences.
Well, you know, just to reduce the number of options, basically. Because I do track with my own custom analytics thing, I do track anonymously font usage. So I can see, I mentioned this before, so I can see which fonts are being used and that when people do pick fonts, what sizes they use with them and what line heights they use with them. So, and what margins. So, so that way, and whether it's dark or light mode and what, and whether it's iPhone or iPad, that way I can tell, like I can adjust the defaults over time and I can see, okay, well, I set the default to be this size, but when everyone uses it, they raise it by one notch. So I should really have the default be that size instead. So yeah, the problem is there's just so much choice that people have. And so people often will change settings in a way that they think will make it more readable. And it actually doesn't, but they don't necessarily notice that, or they don't necessarily assign blame in the right place. So it's kind of bad for both of us. So I really don't think, and yeah, line height is a perfect example of that. Also, you know, like Baskerville. Baskerville is the least popular font by a long shot. In fact, I think Open Dyslexic might be used more than Baskerville. It is by far the least used font because it just does not render well on screen. It has a lot of very, very thin strokes and very, very small letter forms. It just does not render well. And so I don't even know why that's still an option. I really should remove it. But for like, you know, like the 10 people who use it, they're going to be pretty upset if I do that.
They'll be enraged. You know? You'll be their arch enemy at that point.
Right, exactly. They probably also use Opera. So, and the Virtual Boy. All right, so I tell you, one of my friends' families growing up, the only video game systems they had were a TurboGrafx-16 and two Atari Lynxes. Of all things, they have to be the only family in the world.
Actually, that has two Atari
Lynxes. Yes, because both my friend and his dad were hooked on them.
Nice,
so they had two. Anyway, so with the magazine, rather than giving all these different crazy font options and text adjustments, I elected to just pick really good defaults. And the only adjustment you have is dark or light mode, which actually was added pretty late. It was the architecture for it was there from the beginning, but I wasn't sure if it was worth having a button. And then adding that toolbar made it worth it. And text size. Text size, you kind of need that in pretty much everything. I mean, even Twitter clients have that. Text size is one of those things where there really is no good only option. You really need multiple options for that because people just have very different preferences or very different visual abilities and just comfort levels. So you have to have adjustable text sizes if you have nothing else. So other than that, though, I wanted to pick really, really good other options. So, you know, the margins, I feel, as I said earlier, I feel that 10 points, not 10 pixels, sorry, thank you for correcting me, chat room. I think 10 points is the ideal margin size on iPhone for body text. And I think on the iPad, it varies a lot, somewhere between like, you know, 70 and 120, depending on your font and everything else. It varies a lot on the iPad though. Because, you know, you have more room to play with. And so with the magazine, people have asked me, you know, why I chose these fonts, what they are. Okay, so let's go through it and why. The headlines, summaries, and anything you see, and the interface, anything you see that is sans serif. And do we have to explain what that means, or do people get that by now?
I think listeners to this show better know.
Okay.
I don't think we explain that.
The quick version is sans serif fonts look like Helvetica, and serif fonts look like Times New Roman. Okay.
Right. Your two favorite fonts.
Oh, yeah. You know, I actually don't really use Times New Roman for anything. It's actually not a terrible print font. It's not that great on screen, though.
Yeah, but it's not as great on screen. And people probably see it in print all the time and have just sort of come to accept it as the standard. Like when most people think of serif, these days they probably think of Georgia more just because of
the web.
On the web, yeah. But in print, it's probably Times New Roman.
Yeah, and Times New Roman also, like I think Microsoft Word ruined that font. Because that's like, you know, if you launch Microsoft Word and typed a stupid memo to hang in the bathroom about people not cleaning up their paper towels, you would do it in bold Times New Roman.
Right. All caps.
And it was, all caps. And you know, it's just, it is so incredibly overdone that people have seen, like, Times New Roman is basically the "I didn't style this font." It's the "I didn't put any thought into this font." And anyway, so I wanted the magazine to have a unique look, not just look like system defaults. But I also wanted things to be still very readable and somewhat neutral. You know, like when with Instapaper, I think I mentioned this last week or 2 weeks ago, with Instapaper, I have to choose very neutral designs because you don't know what people are going to be reading in it. They could be reading a comedy article. They could be reading a tech article. They could be reading somebody's obituary. You don't want to impart personality much with the fonts and with the design choices that might clash with what people might be reading with it, because you don't know what they're going to be reading with it. With the magazine, I have, you know, they're only reading what I put in there. So I have control over the content. I have a better idea of what the content will and won't be. And so I can make more personality'd, whatever the verb would be to inject personality into something. I can make choices that are more like that. And but at the same time, the magazine subject matter actually is broad. And so I don't want to use things that aren't necessarily universally applicable. So, you know, I play with the color a lot. Thank God for Pacific Helm on that, because I am terrible with color. Especially because the two main colors in the app, depending on whether you're in light or dark mode, are red and blue. It's very, very hard to pick good reds and good blues. So, you know, so in fact, the whole reason why the dark mode color bars are blue is mostly because I couldn't find a good red that would work well with the dark mode scheme. Because red, like if you lighten it, it becomes pink or orange, and it's, yeah, doesn't work. Anyway, so so for the sans serif text in the app, all the interface, the headlines, that is all the font called Avenir Next or Avenir Next Condensed. This is a built-in system font in iOS 6. This is one of the reasons I require iOS 6. In the iOS 5 compatibility mode, it just replaces it with Helvetica Neue Condensed, but that's no fun. Avenir Next is this new font. Using a system font instead of a custom embedded one usually is a better choice if it suits you. For one thing, they're free for iOS developers to use in the apps. You don't have to pay a licensing fee to use Avenir. It also makes your app bundle smaller. You know, a font could be a few hundred kilobytes at least. So you have a smaller app bundle, less for people to download. All the system fonts, I believe the way that it works in the system, all the system fonts are already loaded when your app launches.
They're sort of like loaded in an OS space almost.
Yeah, they're already loaded. They're already in memory in the OS. They're already ready to be used. If you embed a font in your app, that has to be loaded into memory each time your app launches. And then presumably it's unloaded afterwards, though I don't know that for sure. So there actually is a measurable load time difference here. If you have a whole bunch of fonts in your app and you're loading them all up front, your load time will be slower. Also, different fonts that you get from different sources aren't always that well crafted in a technical sense. Sometimes their metrics won't be exactly right, or like they'll have like a weird baseline in the metadata or something. The system fonts are all pretty universally rock solid in this regard because they're tested for this. They're used for this purpose. If you get like a random print font, it might not work well in WebKit or in the system text renderer. Another big one that caught me with some of the Instapaper fonts is that these system fonts have very, very good support for non-Roman alphabets. One of probably the two biggest alphabets that are frequently omitted from third-party fonts are Greek and Russian. And so for the magazine, who cares? All my text is in English. I know I'm going to be publishing zero to very little Greek or Russian text in the app, so I don't really have to worry about that. In Instapaper, though, I do have to worry about that. And a lot of the new fonts I added, I learned afterwards from angry Greek and Russian people, don't support those characters. That's what they do.
There are a lot of angry Greek and Russian people out there.
Well, they all emailed me.
All of them.
What the fonts do in this case, if you have a font that doesn't have those characters in it, what it basically does is fall through to some kind of system default. And so you'll have, like, if you have a document with like mixed text, some of it in Roman characters and some of it in Greek and Russian or Greek or Russian, then it'll have like, you know, the Roman characters in the pretty awesome font and then the Cyrillic characters next to it in like Arial. And it just looks bad. And then they aren't getting the benefit of that font if it just falling back to Arial anyway. That's no good. So that could be a problem with a third party font. Whereas with system fonts, they all support that stuff pretty well. And then a whole other category usually are Arabic, Hebrew, and especially the Asian alphabets, which I'm not at all qualified to discuss. I don't know anything about them, except that usually there are special fonts that are optimized just for Asian alphabets, because they have so many characters that the European language targeted font designers usually can't approach that at all. They can't make that many characters. They can't design them. They're very specialized fonts for those alphabets. Like the if you look through the iPad font list, I think it's iosfonts.com. Let me check. Yeah, iosfonts.com has a whole list of all the available fonts in various versions of iOS. And if you look, there's a few fonts that have names that don't sound very English. That's like a... There's what's the big one? It's like Hira Min Pro N and Hira Kaku Pro N. Sorry for botching these pronunciations. Those are Japanese fonts, I believe. Where, you know, their Roman characters look pretty average, but they have massive libraries of, say, Japanese characters that the system fonts don't. So anyway, something to consider if you need to display those languages.
Now you're not doing anything custom where you're doing like detection there for that. It's always a choice, right? But do you think that the folks in those countries are going to know this automatically just because of their experience with dealing with fonts that don't contain the characters they want to see? And they're going to say, oh, I want to switch to one that's going to have it?
I don't know. I expect that it's similar to the percentage of people who we know who speak English who care about fonts.
Yeah.
You know, I bet most people don't care.
Yeah.
And some people really care. You know, it's I imagine it's very similar.
Right. You know? That's a good way to describe the situation.
So anyway, using a built-in system font. I have my own detection algorithm for whether I need to flip things to left to right. Or right to left for Arabic and Hebrew. But anyway, that's a whole different story. So the magazine, I don't need to worry about that. If you do need to worry about that, I suggest using system fonts only. But in this case, I used Avenir Next as one of the magazine's main fonts, not necessarily because of all these constraints, but because I just liked it a lot. It's new, it's fresh. And since I was requiring iOS 6, I was able to use it and really take advantage of it and really be one of the first visible, you know, very visible apps out there that use this. So I kind of stole the system's font or the system font identity as my identity because I liked it a lot. So everything else in the magazine that's not set in Avenir or something from the Avenir family is set in a font that I used to call Lion Text because I didn't realize there was a place in France this was named after. I now know it's pronounced Lion Text, I think. So anyway, it is a great font. I love it. It is available in Instapaper, simply called Lion. Although the full name of the font is indeed Lion Text. It is fantastic. What I like about this font, it is by far my favorite font to read on a Retina screen, especially on a Retina iPad. It is amazing. It was actually made, I believe, for print, but it just works really well with Retina. And with non-Retina screens, it's decent. It's not amazing, but it's decent. I really compare Lion Text a lot as a replacement to Georgia. I used to use Georgia a lot. What I like about Lion is that... Britinva is saying I'm pronouncing that wrong still.
I don't, okay. Lion, they're saying. Krumpf is saying this. Or is he just suggesting it as a title?
Anyway, What I like about that font, I apologize to France for not being able to pronounce any of their words correctly ever. But, and they can apologize to me for not being able to spell them. All right. So, sorry. Please email Dan. What I like about that font is that it is a neutral, versatile serif body font, like Georgia. But it's with a more refined style and more modern features than Georgia. You know, Georgia is another one of those fonts like Times New Roman that has just been, you know, driven into the ground. We see Georgia constantly. It's everywhere. If you see any text on the internet that is serif, it is probably in Georgia. It's that common. And Georgia is a good font, but it's just so incredibly stale to most of us now. So I like it a lot, but I wanted something fresher. So I chose this Lion, whatever, I don't know. I chose this font instead because I like it a lot in Instapaper. I should point out also, though, that in Instapaper for iPhone, I actually prefer Ideal Sans, but I don't really like it on iPad. Ideal Sans, in my opinion, is very, very good in a very narrow size range. And once you get large enough to be a good reading font on the iPad, I don't like it anymore. I think it's really good, you know, in an iPhone size range. So anyway, that's my quick rant on fonts. That's how I chose those fonts. That's where I'm using them. I love them. They're awesome. Okay. All right, one more sponsor?
Yeah.
Or are there two more? I forgot.
There are actually two more because...
All right, we'll do one more now.
One of these is Symbolicons. You've seen these guys. You're talking about icons and designs. So
I think it's pronounced Symbolicons.
Symbolicons, done by Joey Raphael. He's the guy that does all of the really cool show art for all of these shows, including Build and Analyze, really all of the shows there. And he, by day, earns a living doing design stuff, but he came out with a set of Symbolicons, symbol icons, if you will, that these things have been around for a while now, and they're really cool. They're vector based. You could resize these things to any size that you want. All the glyphs in the core sets have a consistent weight. They're styled to visually match one another, so you don't have like one icon looks like he did it Sunday afternoon, and the next one like he did it a month later, and they're different. They're all fit into a beautiful, beautiful scheme. Makes designing user interfaces feel cohesive and intentional. They're pixel perfect. They're retina ready. You can use them on your iPhone, iPad, just for design anywhere. And he has four distinct sets that makes almost 1,000 icons. Go over there and check him out. He's always expanding. I'm always updating him. And he's the type of guy, if you want a symbol for something, email him. Who knows? It might show up in the next update. Now you can use this code DanLovesIcons at the end of the checkout process to get 15% off over on Symbolicons.com. Dan loves icons. Go check them out.
Do you?
I do. I really do.
I would hate to have, you know, an inaccurate promo code.
I do love them. You can go over to 5x5 and there we have some. The few icons that I have on the current site are by him. Really cool. Small sizes, but these things look really good big.
All right. I want to move a little bit into the CMS. That's basically, I got from Build and Analyze listeners, I got more questions about the CMS than about any other topic with the magazine. So I forget whether I've talked about it yet at all, but I at least haven't talked about it in detail. So here we go. Okay. So first of all, a quick lead in from a question from Sam Freeney. He says, just wondering about the in-app purchase model. Given that I require iOS 6 and I mentioned being worried about server load on launch, why didn't I go with hosted downloads with Apple? Was it a case of easily adding edits or some other reason? Okay, so yes, iOS 6 adds this new in-app purchase thing where Apple can host the download for you and doesn't even need to touch your servers at all. And pretty much, yes, the reason why I didn't do that is for easily adding edits. The CMS is designed... I did custom write it. It is a whole custom CMS written in PHP.
Woo-hoo!
Running on a web server. I know that was just for you and especially for John Siracusa and Jeff Atwood. it was all for Jeff Atwood, really, I should say. Continuing to perpetuate PHP because once again, I didn't want to spend a whole lot of time learning something new. I wanted to do this quickly. So I know that's a terrible reason, but that's what happens in reality a lot. So anyway, I wrote the CMS and the app to work closely together to negotiate syncing in a very lightweight way and a very fast way. And the app, I come to this kind of accidental role in the magazine industry from a background in writing on the web. I've never written for, well, except for one time. Other than that, I've never written for magazines. I've certainly never published a magazine before. I come from the background of the place where you can make typo changes very quickly. So, you know, if you have a blog post and you want to change, want to correct a typo or even like add or remove a whole sentence, I want to be able to do that quickly. So the CMS and the app sync to each other very, very well. And the like, if I want to change a typo in an article, it only redownloads that article to the device. So right now it's less important because the issues are very small because they don't have any images in them. I don't want to have to make people redownload like 10 or 12 megs or more for me to fix a one word typo right. in an article. So I wanted that control over. So that's why I didn't use the new iOS 6 system. All right. Now moving on. I got tons of questions just about how the CMS works, what features it has. Here's basically what it does. It is a very, very, very simple system. It looks hideous, as most self-written CMSs do, because you're writing it for yourself and there's a lot less reason to make it look really pretty and polished. There's a lot of things about it that are clunky. Like to upload images, you have to save it first because otherwise it doesn't have an ID yet in the database. And the images are stored with the ID. And at the bottom, I literally write something along the lines of like, hit save to upload images first because I'm a lazy programmer. So I actually wrote that text in the interface.
What
to
is that
myself.
Saying? The shoemaker's children have no shoes or something like that?
Yeah, the shoemaker's children use PHP. And don't.
That's it.
And they need IDs before they can save things.
Right.
Everything in the magazine that you see, for the most part, is done manually. The link preview popovers, I mentioned in the Syracuse of follow-up episode, the link preview popover content is first auto-populated with a sensible default of what I think the title and author and text should be, but I then edit those manually all, you know, and I have to edit almost all of them. So all those link fields are all edited. They're all little boxes that stack up and look amazingly crazy when you get an article like from Syracuse that has a million links in it. You get all these giant stack of boxes of all these link info things. The CMS is all natively Markdown. It does Markdown and Smarty Pants because that's just how it should be. And so everything, all my quotes are curly. All my dashes are solid. Everything is pretty. And what else? It does not yet do versioning, but I'm going to add that. The authors don't write their own content. I still paste it. The authors don't edit their own content directly in the CMS. I'm still pasting it in. I've also recently hired an editor. I'm not sure if I'm supposed to mention it yet. So, sorry, I'm not going to mention it yet.
Okay.
But I did recently hire an editor, so now he is in there. I've given away that it's a male, so I've ruled out half the population.
Yeah, you'll be more than half, I think. More than half.
Actually, I think it's a little bit less than half.
Is it less than half now?
I believe, yeah. Oh, no, I've ruled out more than half. Less than half is left. Yes, okay. This is confusing. Let me see what else people ask about the CMS. I covered most of it. It's boring because it's just a CMS that was custom written. It's not a very exciting topic. I did build it from scratch. The reason why I didn't adapt an existing system, a lot of people ask me, you know, why did you build it from scratch rather than just using System X? I think we've mentioned occasionally in the past, it is so difficult working with other CMSs. If you have simple needs, like in this case, I have very, very simple needs and kind of specific simple needs also. If you have very simple needs, it's generally the same or more work to work in somebody else's CMS, customizing it and making plugins and such.
Oh, yeah.
Than it is to just write your own.
Well, it's the same way I started with 5x5. I didn't want to build something custom. Right. I said that's not, as Merlin would say, that's not in my wheelhouse right now. I'm making shows. I'm making content. I'm working on, you know, on building something else here. I don't want to build a CMS. But then, so then I sat down with, I won't name them all, but probably half a dozen well-known content management systems, some free, some for pay. Spent a lot of time, probably over the course of a month, devoting to, can I use these other systems to do what I want? I said, you know, I finally found one or two that I said, okay, they could work with these plugins. And if I write this much code, and I said, you know what, just what you, the same conclusion you came to, just build it yourself. If you know that you can, and if you want to do something like you're saying, very specific, and then, you know, yeah, it, you're the one that's then have to maintain the thing later, but you're going to get exactly what you need. No more, no less. And there's a lot to be said for that.
Yeah, it really, I mean, because, you know, there's a reason why CMS customization and maintenance is such a massive consulting industry, because there's a ton of work to be done there. And, you know, because every publication or blogger or company, everyone has slightly different needs. So no CMS will work stock out of the box for everyone. And yeah, like, you know, if, like in the case of 5x5, you really are doing very heavy customizations there. Like I'm imagining trying to like cram, you know, WordPress or Drupal into what you want to do with 5x5. And there, you have so much custom stuff there, it would be a ton of work. And also these days, you know, it makes sense for somebody who's not a programmer to not write their own CMS, obviously. But if you're a web programmer these days, we have so many amazingly efficient frameworks to use now.
Yeah.
And all these frameworks, you know, Rails and Django and all the other ones, all, you know, I don't know, I don't use them. I use my own because I'm that kind of guy. But all these frameworks make this specific kind of thing really easy to do. You know, if you want to use a web framework to write a game, you're going to have a tough time. But if you want to use a web framework to write a CRUD database app that has, you know, user logins and manages blog posts, that's really easy to do in all these frameworks. They're all optimized to do this exact kind of thing. So it really isn't that much work, unless your needs are extremely complex, in which case any solution you pick is going to be a lot of work. So yes, I did write it all myself. It is not based on Second Crack. It is a whole separate thing. It is not based on static HTML. Again, all separate. But it is a custom CMS that I wrote. One of the options that people were probably going to ask about, especially since I'm involving newsstand and push notifications and in-app purchase auto-renewing subscriptions, is why I didn't use a hosted solution like Urban Airship. Urban Airship does have a newsstand publisher option. I looked at their page for that. Generally speaking, I found, I don't know the people behind this, so I guess take this with a grain of salt, but the Urban Airship site seemed extremely enterprisey to me, and the newsstand publisher product that they have in particular was one of those enterprise products that they don't even tell you the price on the site. It's like, contact us and we'll talk about how much money you can give us. It's one of those things, you know? So I looked at that and was turned off and just thought, you know what? If this is one of those contact us pricing things, I probably can't afford it. That's usually what that means. Usually what that means is this is meant for big businesses. So especially in the context of newsstand publishing, I figure they made this product to target people like the New Yorker. You know, people who have big companies behind them and presumably big budgets behind them and people who need the stuff that they can provide that's hard to write yourself and people who just can't write a simple solution themselves. And that does not fit me at all. I'm one person, I had a small budget, and all the push notification stuff, I just wrote it myself. And the purchase validation and tracking, I wrote that myself too. It wasn't that hard. All those hosted systems, I actually didn't find any other ones that did newsstand besides Urban Airship. There are a few other push notification services, but none of them that I, as far as I could find, did newsstand. But because it was so easy for me to write my own, I just wrote my own. You know, as easy as that.
Now, how about maintaining this down to the future when, you know, when you're just out on your boat, someone finds a, you know, they want to, you want to add a feature, you want to change something, you want to make it look good. You've got your editors complaining that there's a feature that he really wants that's not there.
I'm not really into boats. I think, you know,
your private plane, whatever, your mountain refuge, whatever it is, your retreat center. I mean, at that point, what happens?
A retreat center is like a safe room.
It's like a safe room in a mountain that only you have access to, and you can only get to it
there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, the editor already has requested a few features. The fact is, it's really easy for me to add this stuff because, again, I'm working with a web framework that's optimized for doing this exact stuff.
So you're in charge of it. You don't want to let go of control of that. And I know exactly what you're talking about because
you're the same way.
No, I am. I'm maybe worse if that's imaginable, because it's the same thing that now, you know, we're working on some changes to the 5x5 site to make it easier to find stuff. And I'm at the point, like, you know, like I want to do kind of what you did in the sense of, you know, working with somebody to do the things that I simply am ill-suited for and incapable of doing, like design level stuff. But the behind the scenes stuff, the code, like, I'm just not ready to turn that over to someone else. It makes no sense for me to be doing it, except that I know exactly how it needs to be done and the time investment that it would take for me to bring somebody else up to speed to be able to do it would be way more than just doing it myself. And then the counter argument to this, Marco, is that, well, if you teach someone else to do it and then you have them or explain it to them, it's not rocket science, then they can do it and then you just don't have to do it yourself anymore. Well, what if I want to make a tweak at, you know, 2 p.m. on a Sunday afternoon and I'm not familiar with the framework that they're using or I'm not familiar with the code that they're doing? Well, then you just have to deal with it. That's what the big companies do. So I struggle with this. I struggle with this myself. I'm back and forth on it.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's one of those things where, you know, the grass is always greener. Like, whichever option you pick, you're going to think about the other one and say, oh, maybe I should have written it myself / used somebody else's. You know, like there's always going to be, and you're always going to, every time you add a feature, you'll think, oh, you know, if I would have just used pre-built CMS X, I would have gotten this for free.
Right.
But in reality, you don't get those things for free. Like, there's all these costs of doing either choice. You know, like there's features that are hard to write yourself. And so if you're writing your own CMS, you're going to have an occasional point where it's like, man, this, I wish I could have just used somebody else's for this. But you would have just as many of those moments if you use somebody else's and you can't figure out how to do something really simple because it's buried in some kind of complex code. And you're like, how the heck do I just change this one little thing? If this was my code, I'd know how to do this in a second. You know, so you're always going to have that dilemma. Neither solution is perfect. So, actually, related to this, I was going to get to this a little bit later, but I'll get to it now.
Okay.
There was a good question from Tom Wordsworth, and he says, any thoughts on franchising the code or technical management necessary to run the magazine to other editors / curators, I hate that word, of other medium to long form text-oriented niche publications? It's a lot of words.
It is a lot of words.
Kind of seems like the obvious business move, so of course I understand if you'd rather not discuss this on air. No, I will. Assuming the magazine business model proves to be a success. It would be the flip side of the entire readability payment saga, provide a viable and straightforward ecosystem for writers and editors. And okay, I'm falling asleep. All right, so this is another question I get a lot, another thing I've gotten a few emails about, people saying, can you white label this, basically? Can they take the magazine's source code and CMS and license it and make their own publication using it? Right now, the answer is no. I don't know what the future will hold. I don't really have any immediate plans to go into that business. The problem with that, I talked about this somewhere. I forget. I hope it wasn't here. Too many podcasts, Dan. The problem with that approach is that it's very human and time intensive to manage that kind of relationship. If I had like, you know, 10 different magazine publishers all licensing this code from me and making their own stuff on it, I have to work with them. It's very similar to the custom CMS problem, is that each one of them is going to have like two features that they really need to have that I then have to add to the code base or the CMS. And so that's a very different business. It's similar to consulting in the amount of time it takes and the amount of human relationship management it takes. And it's similar to the enterprise software business in that you have a lot of resources needed, but very few customers. So you have to charge them a lot of money. That's basically what the enterprise software business is like. And that's why enterprise software costs like, you know, $100,000 a year at least to use for some kind of major package. So that's a very different business from the business I'm in now, which is focus on making this one publication great. Add only the things that I need in it. Add nothing else to it. And you know, the way I make more money is by getting more subscribers to my one publication. That's just the other side of that of becoming the enterprise vendor here and having, you know, this system that I license to other people and maybe take a profit share or some kind of giant licensing fee they wouldn't be able to afford, things like that. That's just a business I really don't want to be in right now. And if I ever did that, I would probably hire somebody else to do it entirely because I wouldn't want to do that myself. But right now, that's not really what I'm thinking about doing. The other problem with that is that I don't think I want like 10 other publications on newsstand look exactly like the magazine. Like I think that would kind of take away from the magazine somewhat if there were X number of effectively clones for just different genres of content. I also would, at some point there would be some kind of uncomfortable thing where I'd be competing with them. Like if somebody wants to write an article about sports in the magazine and one of my clients for the white label thing is a sports publication, that's kind of awkward. You know, like there would be all these little problems that would come up. I don't want to be in those positions. I don't want to manage that kind of business. And I don't want to have a whole bunch of identical looking magazines in the store that all look like my design, even if they're paying me. You know, it's confusing.
You just have one place, and then there's something to be said for scarcity too, right? And there's something to be said for having one thing that's definitive, and maybe you don't need to expand into every single other topic and category in the world.
Exactly. All right. And then another question. We'll want to do one more. We have one more sponsor, right?
Yeah, we get one more longtime sponsor, MailChimp.com. Easy email right. Newsletters. They help you design email newsletters, share them on social networks, integrate with services you already like. And the cool thing is you can track your results. I use their little, they have a thing called Chimp Kit. And there's another one so that if you're an iOS developer, you can embed newsletter signups right in your app. Same thing for Android. And we have that in both the 5x5 streaming apps. So if you click tap a little newsletter thing, you can sign up right there, which is really, really cool. All this is built in. It's free. And you can have 2,000 subscribers. You can send 12,000 emails per month for free forever. And you just go to MailChimp.com/5x5. You support the show by doing it. You can sign up there. You don't have to pay anything. You can start sending your newsletters right away. You can integrate them into your app right away. They've got Mandrill, which allows you to send emails from within your web application too. I mean, all of this stuff is there. They really do a lot to support developers, and you should really go check them out. They're my newsletter of choice and have been for many, many years, way before I started 5x5. Maybe they'll be yours too. MailChimp.com/5x5. Check it out.
And finally,
and in conclusion,
I have a question. We got to get Hodgman to read that. Got a question from from Mark Bone, I think.
It's pronounced Bonet.
Well, it's B-O-H-N, so it's probably not pronounced Bonet.
Bon.
It could be Bon.
Bon.
I'm going to say Bone. All right. I honestly think that's more likely here.
I think
okay,
right.
So anyway. Question from Mark Bone. Sorry if that's wrong. if that is wrong, he's probably heard that a lot. Anyway, he says, and this is long, so forgive me. I've come to the conclusion that the only place I can get properly roasted coffee is at home. I began roasting my own beans earlier this year after hearing you talk about how badly over-roasted Starbucks coffee is. I recall that the exact phrase you used was burnt ash. At first, I thought you were just ranting, but I decided to start roasting my own, and now I'm a total convert. But I found that anywhere else I go, the beans are over-roasted. Not usually to the extent that Starbucks over-roasts, but far enough that most, if not all, of what Sweet Maria's calls origin character is lost. For me, the origin character is what coffee is all about. I roast most of my beans a little past first crack. The only explanation for why the shops over-roast is that most people must like their coffee that way or just expect the coffee to taste that way. It could also be that inventory management and shelf life considerations force them to over-roast. Any opinions? Yes.
Care to share your opinions?
I guess. Yeah, that's probably a good follow-up question.
I think that's what he was meaning to imply with his question.
Yeah.
I'm guessing.
Okay. After all that, you think he was looking for more than one word?
Maybe.
Okay. All right. I agree with most of what he says. I think Starbucks does over-roast their beans. I've talked about in the past why this is. The short version is that when you roast your beans extremely dark, you can get a stronger flavor out of them. And the flavor you get out of them, if you go too far, is not a very good flavor, but it is stronger. And this has two major advantages to mass market coffee production. One is, as he said, shelf life. If you roast the crap out of your beans and make them super dark, they will have a flavor for longer. Medium and light roasts tend to get stale and really weaken their flavor a lot after, like, you know, 1 or 2 weeks after roasting. But if you roast extremely dark, you can have it sitting on the shelf at Trader Joe's for 6 months, and people can still open it and taste some kind of strong flavor. It won't be as good as when it's fresh, but it will still be a strong flavor. For places like Starbucks, this is obviously very important. As you said, for inventory management, you just have, you know, you'll have distribution centers where you have a giant roastery somewhere, and then you ship it out to all your various Starbucks locations, and then it sits in bags or in tubs for a long time, and then eventually they brew it. You know, some places will have freshly roasted beans just because, you know, coincidence, or they do enough volume. Most places won't. So that's important. The other major factor is that so many people who buy coffee today have always put cream and sugar into it, or milk and sugar, whatever they choose.
Soy.
So many people.
Now, wait a minute. You don't like soy milk, right?
No, it's not for me. I mean, I don't really have a problem with it. Okay. I just don't like it.
It's not good. Good for you.
I just don't like putting stuff in coffee. That's the bigger offense.
Yeah, I'm with you there.
The problem is that so many people are accustomed to putting cream and sugar in their coffee, and not even just a little bit. Like, they're accustomed to putting in enough to substantially change the flavor.
Mm-hmm.
And sugar masks the flavor pretty severely. Milk or cream, or I guess soy probably does this too, kind of dulls the flavor. You know, by making the creaminess, it kind of blocks your tongue from tasting much of the coffee. And then the sugar competes with the coffee flavor and tries to, you know, bang it out of there. So when you have people who are accustomed to adding these two components that both replace and dull the original coffee flavor, the coffee has to have a pretty strong taste to begin with to make it taste like anything but sugar milk afterwards. And you can't convince the public at large to just use less or use no sugar and milk in their coffee. That's a losing battle. You'll never win that battle. So the way most of these places overcome that is simply by roasting the crap out of their coffee, so it has such a strong, bitter, burnt ash flavor that after people have adulterated it with cream and sugar, they can still taste something resembling coffee. It just works out better that way. It's, you know, even though if you drink it black, it tastes awful. The fact is most people don't drink it black, at least in the U.S. I can't speak for the whole world, obviously.
No.
Please email Dan if you can.
Yes.
So that's why they do it. Somebody in the chat, I got to scroll up here. Somebody in the chat, as soon as we started talking about this, mentioned, it's East Outen in the chat, mentioned Gorilla Coffee in Brooklyn. I used to live near Gorilla Coffee when I did live in Brooklyn. I find that to be the case with them, that they roast way too dark for my taste. Even my favorite roaster, which is Aroma Coffee in Larchmont, New York, even they roast pretty dark and sometimes a little bit too dark for my taste, but not always. I do like darkly roasted coffee. I usually bring it right to second crack or a few seconds after second crack. But there's a narrow range there where it tastes really good to me. But then if you go too far, then it's just burnt ash. So that's obviously no good. What a lot of coffee nerds, though, like I think Mark Bonnerbone is probably one of these, a lot of coffee nerds really love like those kind of lighter, more subtle, sweeter notes that you get with much lighter roasts. For example, I used to subscribe to Tonks, which is a popular coffee roasting service. Tonks is very, very good. Degas Roast is a little bit too light for my taste. But if you go to Tonks, or if you go to like Stumptown, or like some of like the new like modern coffee nerd run places, they do tend to roast way lighter than Gorilla Coffee or Aroma or my own roasts. I just happen to like it dark, but I think there's a good middle ground there between Tonks and Gorilla Coffee, where there can be really good dark roasts, and the stores could use those. It's just easier not to, because if you go too far, so it tastes like crap when it's black, it still has a stronger flavor and people put all their crap in it. And with that, I think we're done.
That's it. Done. We haven't done a coffee talk in a long time. I was just thinking about that.
Well, never too late to start.
No, it never is. So if people would like to learn more about coffee, they can go to marco.org, which is your site. They can follow you on Twitter, Marco Arment, A-R-M-E-N-T. They can follow you on Alpha as just Marco. Are you on Tentis?
I think. I signed up one night and then promptly forgot about it.
Is it marco.tentis?
I think.
Okay. Try that,
I guess.
And
I want that to take off. I really do.
Me
I just
too.
Don't think it's going to happen, but I want that to take off. Because I would rather invest my posts, I guess. I'd rather invest my time and attention, to use a Merlinism, into this protocol that I can move around and that's independent of any one company, than build up a huge presence on something like app.net. But I just think it's not going to happen. I'd love to prove him wrong on that.
Yeah, we'll see. I'm Dan Benjamin on Twitter, Dan on Alpha, and I think Dan Benjamin on Tentis. And you can go to 5by5.tv/buildanalyze/102 to see some of the links that Marco was talking about for fonts and other things that we collected during the show. And I think that's it. Visit the sponsors, rate us in the iTunes store, check out the Instapaper app and the magazine. When is the next issue due out? Is it this week or next week?
It is this week. Probably it's officially out on Thursday, but I'll probably do what I did last time and publish it late Wednesday night instead.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks everybody for tuning in. Thank you, Marco.
Thanks.